What's at stake in Syria's convulsions? Do Trump's national security appointees form a coherent team?
Why is healthcare taking the spotlight right now, but in such a sick way? And what about Trump's economic team? Are these guys primed to deliver low inflation and prosperity? Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. And welcome to Independent Outlook. I've got some experts lined up for you today to discuss these questions and more. As always, I'm joined by my conversation partner, Dr. Philip Magnus, holder of Independent Institute's David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Welcome, Phil Magnus.
Happy to be here.
Also joined by my colleague, Dr. Williamson Evers, Director of our Center on Educational Excellence. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
And especially today, we're joined by Dr. Ivan Eland. He heads our Center on Peace and Liberty and is always on call with national media to comment on foreign and military affairs. So glad to have you, Ivan.
Hi, everybody. Glad to be here.
So, Ivan, let's start with you and with Syria. Just a few days ago, the government of Syrian dictator President Bashar al-Assad collapsed into the hands of militant factions led by somebody named Abu Muhammad al-Gulani. Assad, not surprisingly, ran to Russia, and Syria's prime minister offered the welcome mat to al-Gulani, who promised that Syria is for everyone. What's going on here? What should we pay attention to, Ivan?
Well, we can pay attention to what happens after the revolution. The revolution is now started, but of course, revolutions never really end where they start. And of course, we've seen this in the Arab Spring, which was believe it or not, this revolution started 13 years ago in 2011, maybe even 2010 for the Arab Spring. And then it sort of quieted down in 2020. And then all of a sudden, the rebels, and these are some of the groups are Islamist radicals, they took advantage of the other side being the Syrian government, Iran, and Iran's sponsor, the group that Iran sponsors, Hezbollah, and Russia, who was also helping support the Assad regime. They all are either distracted by the war, say, in Ukraine for Russia, or they've recently come into harder times by being attacked in one way or another by the Israeli military. So they took advantage of this, that all the supports of this illegitimate regime were sort of less strong, and they took advantage of that. And it's remarkable, less than 2 weeks, 11 days, they made it to Damascus and overthrew the regime. Now what?
Yeah, because there were like about, 10,000 of them who overthrowing the Assad army of 130,000 plus 4,000 Russian troops plus Hezbollah. How in the world did this David and Goliath thing happen? I guess they were all distracted and depleted elsewhere.
I also think that the Syrian army didn't fight. They just gave up because nobody liked the Assad. The Assad family has been running Syria for 54 years, and they've been brutal, torturing people, and their human rights record was atrocious, including the alleged use of chemical weapons on their own people. So I think really the problem was their allies were distracted, but the legitimacy of the regime was so bad that none of the Syrian units really put up much of a fight at all. Usually you have one or a few, like the Presidential Guard in these coup situations usually at least puts up some fight, but I don't think there was anybody that put up a fight for Assad.
I read in The Atlantic a piece by Elliot Cohen, who argued that Iran and Russia are the big losers in this regime change in Syria. And the reason for that is that Russia is depleted by being distracted in Ukraine with its military establishment bogged down. And Iran, of course, overextended itself and didn't really anticipate the Israeli responses to October 7th. Are Iran and Russia the big losers here? And what does that mean for the U.S.?
Yeah, I would say they are. I think the temptation, though, from U.S. policy perspective is to leap in here and get as much advantage as we can. And you say, well, what's that? And that's the key question. What are we getting out of it security-wise? I mean, we've caused so many of the problems that exist in Syria, not all of them. Obviously, you have Iran meddling, you have Turkey meddling, you have Russia meddling, but we did try to overthrow Assad, and that led that put have a big would create a big vacuum for ISIS, and then we had to go back into Iraq and Syria to combat the ISIS. And supposedly we have 900 troops still there in northeastern Syria to try to fight the remnants of ISIS. Of course, it was justified to Trump during the first Trump administration as protecting the oil in Syria. Well, there's not that much oil and it's not very valuable. So what are they still doing there is the big question. And I think the United States would actually be better just to stay. We're pulling out. The Syrians have to decide this. And future meddling is going to lead to future problems, I think. And there may be a continued civil war, but Syria may be strategic to Iran and Israel, but it's not really strategic to the United States. And I think we have to start making decisions in the United States based on, we always hear on TV, well, this is a strategic area, but they never say, well, to who? Is it really in the U.S. interest? Is it really for U.S. national security that we're there? I heard one commentator this morning say, well, we need to keep the troops there because we have all these 1,500 ISIS fighters and their families locked up, basically, and they'll escape if these forces leave. And I'm thinking they can't teach the Kurds how to prison operations or whatever. It seemed like it was a little shaky. So no one, I think, really knows why they're still there other than to get a damage. And they were really still trying to overthrow Assad from being there. And now it's been done. I don't think they had much to do with it. But so the question is, the U.S., I think, would have a better role in being an honest broker among the factions, because we already have fighting between the Turkish sponsored rebels and the Kurds, because the Turks have supported these rebels and now they want their payback. And what they want is for them to attack the Kurds, and because the Turks regard the Kurds in Syria as helping the PKK rebels, the Kurdish rebels in Turkey. So that's Turkey's big thing. They want that border cleared. They want and they want the Kurds put down. And so there's already been some skirmishing. And then if we've got U.S. bombing ISIS and Israel bombing the chemical weapons in Syria, and also creating a buffer along the Golan Heights, the occupied Golan Heights. And so we've got all these people are already meddling in the outcome. So I'm a little bit pessimistic that they can, create a situation where all the groups in Syria, I mean, this is just like Iraq, only worse. There's so many, there's even more groups in Syria than there were in Iraq.
So we're happy with the Trump, Donald Trump's tweet the other day when he said, Syria is a mess. The U.S. should have nothing to do with it.
Well, I totally agree with that. But, okay. What we saw in the first Trump administration was, I think Trump has good inclinations in foreign policy, but he had a lot of hawks in his advisors. And we're going to discuss that next. But there's overwhelming amount of hawks in his designated people he wants to get in the top security positions. There's a couple like Tulsi Gabbard and their envoy from the Middle East that are a little bit less interventionist, but mainly the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, if they all get confirmed, they're all hawks as well. So he may not be able to. He tried to get the forces out of there as he did in Afghanistan, and the military and the defense establishment, the security establishment, managed to convince him not to do it.
Let's go back there in a minute, but Bill had a comment.
Yeah, it's interesting that the Syrian Arab Army, which is the government, the Assad government forces, collapsed so quickly because they are, the officer corps is from the Alawite sect, which is a breakoff branch of Shiite Islam. And it's a minority, but it's dominated the Ba'athist Party and the Assad regime in Syria. And, you know, just as the Kurds fear that they are going to be mistreated by a Sunni Muslim government, the Alawites have a history. I mean, they went into the army, they went into the Ba'ath Party in order to protect themselves. And they may face some kind of horrible retribution now. It's interesting that they collapsed so quickly. In terms of the Kurds, it's a fascinating case because the Kurds are led by anarcho-communists. So it's actually one of the more interesting situations in world history that the U.S. government is supporting left-wing anti-private property anarchists. Nothing like classical liberals, but you know, but it's still an unusual situation.
I'm worried by the thought that you introduced a moment ago, Ivan, where you were making a kind of retrospective comparison to what happened in Iraq. I mean, everybody kind of rejoiced when Saddam Hussein was taken down, his statue was toppled, just the way Assad's statue was toppled, and so forth. But it turned out that the loss of Saddam was not the ushering in of a golden era of liberty and order for the people of Iraq, but rather the unleashing of a whole bunch of forces. Is it going to be as bad as that in Syria?
Well, it could very well be. The pessimists would say yes. And also you can include Libya, because the same thing happened in Libya when they popped off the top of Gaddafi, which they really didn't need to do. And of course, we have a partition country there now. So, and of course, in Iraq, we had the chaos, and now we have an uneasy democracy with that in quotes. When you mess up with these countries, there's the ethno-religious sectarian fissures in these countries because they're all artificially drawn after World War I. And so these groups are within, well, the Kurds are in four countries. And they want their own, their objective is to have their own country or at least be autonomous in all four countries. And so you have all these factors that it'll be a miracle if they can pull this off. But also for this HTS group, they've talked the talk recently. This guy went away from Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and they talk about, well, all religions are welcome. We're going to have women's rights and that sort of thing. But whether they really do this, that's what the Taliban said. And then they didn't really, you know, go there.
Also, we have the record of this group ruling a province of Syria. And the complaints, the protests in that country were very high taxes, unbearably high, a kleptocratic rule. In other words, the officials were stealing whatever wasn't nailed down, torture. Now, I'm sure they weren't able to live up to the unbelievably horrific torture and execution that went under the Assad family's regime, but torture is never good. And so, you know, it certainly doesn't look like from a human rights, civil liberties point of view that the now triumphant rebel group has a sterling record.
Looking back at the Iraq case, it was unusual, but apparently it was true that the historic Christian minority community in Iraq had gotten a little bit of cover from Saddam Hussein. And apparently the same was said among some of the historic Christian community people in Syria, that they got a bit of cover from Assad. I wonder what their fate will be.
Well, yes, that Assad really did protect the minorities, and he got more support from them, I think, than he got from, you know, the Sunni majority. And so the Christians, the Druze down in the south, et cetera. So it's sort of very similar to Iraq, although, a true Middle Eastern expert might say, well, there's some differences, and there are, but it's still the same as it's a fractured society, and you have all these groups. And the question is, can they make that the only thing they could do would be to agree on how to partition it and make it into a confederation. But they would have to agree on the boundaries of where the autonomous regions were. I would think that would be about the only thing they could do.
a Switzerland solution.
Yes, yeah.
Huh. Something that like would that. Be interesting. Somehow I doubt it would be as stable as Switzerland, but
right.
Hey, I guess we'll
there has to be a political culture for democracy.
Right.
And most of these countries,
as
we saw in the Arab Spring, we had five countries, if you want to include Syria, but the other four, Tunisia and Egypt ended up as a dictatorship. The dictatorship took back over, and Libya and Iraq are basically, we don't count Iraq. We should count Libya and what's the fourth one? Yemen. Those two countries are partitioned, basically. So, and those aren't very stable. So I don't think the problem here, I think, is that we're trying to get advantage like everybody else, all the other countries. And we're also trying to, and even we're trying to do this here, we're trying to engineer the outcome here. And I think we need U.S. foreign policy. It would be better if we withdrew our forces and said, listen, we're happy to be an honest broker here. Because when those forces are on the ground guarding the oil, Syrian oil, that we lose all credibility as an honest broker. But I think, if we did something like that, we would have, this country is not strategic to us. It's strategic to Iran,
right?
Because they were using it to funnel a land bridge to their favorite group, Hezbollah. Of course, Hezbollah is already in bad shape, and the Iran air defenses have been shot to pieces. So I can understand why it would be very strategic to Iran and Israel, because it's right next door to Israel with the Golan Heights and whatnot. But is it really strategic to the U.S.? And I think it would probably be better to realize that it's not and act accordingly.
Speaking of the Golan Heights, the leader of the rebel forces, his last name means from the Golan Heights.
Oh.
Right,
Al
yes,
Golani.
He's from the Golan Heights. Yes.
That's interesting, Bill. That's a detail that escaped me.
So well, I can't imagine that he's probably going to be too pro-Israeli because they probably kicked him out of his family, out of their homes initially, which is, I think, what happened to him.
Okay, so I've not given Phil much of a chance to talk, so step in, Phil, if you have something you want to add here. But I want to kind of turn the focus to the U.S., unless you have something, Phil, on the ground in Syria.
Well, I think this is a good transition point, because I'm not so certain of the nominees that would be coming into the new Trump administration if there's a clear consensus of where they stand on the Middle East. And
right.
I see someone... Pete Hegseth is the Secretary of Defense nominee, and on some margins he's advocated restraint, but he also has a history of some pretty violent rhetoric regarding some of the Middle Eastern questions. And I don't know if that's what's going to win out, or I don't know if he's changed his views, or someone like Tulsi Gabbard, who seems to be more moderate, more in favor of an actual restraint, if her position is going to win the day versus some of the other people that he's brought in. But it's really interesting that it's a mixture of restraint and hawkishness.
It's quite a mixture. I mean, is it even going to work? Is this like shaking up oil and water and hoping that they stay emulsified? Because, I mean, there's this Michael Waltz, who I guess he's going to be the National Security Advisor. Apparently he's on record as advocating a reinvasion of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good grief.
Yes.
And yet you have people like Tulsi Gabbard and so forth who seem to have the opposite approach. Will this gel, Ivan, this team of Trump appointees in national security?
Well, the only two moderates or restraint, people for restraint, are the Tulsi Gabbard, if she gets if she gets confirmed, which is in doubt, I think. And then... Donald Trump's, Donald Trump's daughter's father-in-law, who is the new Middle Eastern.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right.
Boulos from he's Lebanese. So he's more moderate, but the rest are all hawks. And, Waltz has even advocated putting U.S. troops on the ground in Ukraine. And that's a very bad idea.
Whoa. That's a really strong idea. Good grief.
So Waltz's wife was an intelligence officer in Iraq when I was there.
Oh, wow.
I knew her, not super well, wow. but I knew her.
Well, Pete Hegseth says his views have changed. Is that likely to be accurate?
Well, he's changed on the, at least rhetorically, on the Iraq war, because he was really pro-Iraq war. He's since said that, well, we probably should have just left Saddam there and we wouldn't have the, you know, Iran increasing its influence, which anybody could have told him that before the war started. And I was one of those
Some
people
did.
Who were telling him and they didn't right. do anything about it. But so I think, but as far as Iran, he's an ultra hawk on Iran. And I think, you know, the president to be, I think, has some tendencies. Now, there's also been some, to be fair, there's also been some talk about an overture to Iran by Trump, because Trump is, Iran has been weakened. And for right. because all of these reasons, you know, the war and the Hezbollah in Gaza have been, the Hamas in Gaza have been weakened. And then Israel attacked Iran directly. So, and apparently Elon Musk met with the UN ambassador to Iran, who's very influential, since the U.S. has no other representative. You know, there's no talk. This is the only ambassador that's in the United States is to the UN.
Right.
Not Iran so doesn't one, have a regular ambassador. So, you know, there might be an opening, and Sir Trump does like to negotiate with, you know, people that we have as enemies or adversaries. And I always
let's
think
make
that's a
deal.
Good idea, even if it doesn't work out.
Yeah, let's make a deal.
So there's in foreign policy establishment circles, there's also the following point being made. Iran has been weakened by the problems that Hamas has had, the problems that Hezbollah has had, the overthrow of Assad, and the direct blows against Iran state proper in terms of the missiles going in and so forth. So what is feared is that Iran will step up, it will escalate its creation, its production of atomic bomb materials. And this is something that worries the United States a lot, worries Israelis a lot. And so part of a possible motivation for Trump making a deal is not just the fun and glory of making a deal, although I acknowledge that he likes to do it. And he, of course, it's easier to do it with autocrats than it is with democratic countries, because you know, for obvious reasons. So this may be part of what is an impetus behind this.
Mm-hmm. Let's make the Middle East great again.
Okay. That'd be a good idea.
I think we have...
actually, if you think about it, the Abraham Accords and the possible rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Israel were bringing
that was pretty remarkable. Yeah,
peace and commercial interchange,
right?
Mm-hmm. Which helps support peace.
Yeah, those Arab governments have wanted to do this for a long time, but their Arab street, as they call it, the people in their countries just say no. We want Israel to give Palestinians a state, and so, you know, that's the sticking question. And Hamas has made that more relevant now. And of course, Israel in the long term is going to have a problem of what to do with Hamas. You know, you could end up with a situation like the U.S. has had in Iraq, where it becomes a guerrilla warfare and they just can't, you know, it's just a mess for years to come.
We are grateful for your insight on these things, Ivan. We're going to turn the page and talk about some other items. Thanks for joining us for this part of the conversation. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
So, my remaining colleagues here, let's talk about some of Trump's other appointees. How about Robert Kennedy Jr.? I mean, he's got a public presence that, you know, Trump could hardly resist, it seems to me. And nowadays,
more and more people actually have been taking seriously his claims about fluoridation and vaccine and autism and so forth. Have either of you changed your mind about...
I find him the most difficult to swallow of all of Trump's proposed nominees. I will say that my friend Scott Atlas, was also a friend of the Independent Institute, but is based basically at the Hoover Institution. He says, well, he's raising important questions, which is a good way of saying, I probably think he's wrong on most of those questions, but, you know, it never hurts to look at them again. I find him, you know, there are a few things where he's advancing freedom, like the freedom to drink dangerous, raw, unpasteurized milk, which you should have that freedom, but, you know, I certainly wouldn't counsel anybody to do it. You know, and if you want to, depending on how you look at vaccines and whether carrying around a contagious disease is like an attack and a threat to other people, or whether it's walking around that way is freedom, some of his ideas about not having to take vaccines could fall into a classical liberal viewpoint. But I don't think he, even though he talks about freedom sometimes, I don't think he takes his stance on vaccines really on a freedom basis. It's really that he thinks that vaccines are dangerous and should be, he says now it should be an option, but it used to be his position was they should be banned, they should be stopped. So his theory is that the childhood vaccines that people take have caused autism or other things. The autism claim has, there is probably no medical question relating to, you know, preventative care. It hasn't been studied more. It hasn't been debunked more. It's absolutely clear that these vaccines do not cause autism. He has other, I could go on and on, but he favors, certainly wants to attack processed food. Well, you know, it's not the way the food is prepared that's important in terms of health. It's whether you're getting nutritious food and whether you're not loading yourself down with a lot of calories. It's not the preparation. So, you know, yogurt, which is about as healthy as anything could be, is a ultra-processed food. Cheerios or some other whole, you know, shredded wheat. These are whole grain processed food that are quite nutritious and good for you. Same with whole grain bread. This is a processed, ultra processed food. It's good for you. I mean, if you're a diabetic, I wouldn't recommend having a lot of it, but for regular people, whole grain bread is a very good thing. He's just wrong about ultra processing being the thing that we should watch out for. It's not linked to obesity. There is no some kind of overwhelming evidence that the ultra-processed food, yes, it's true that we've gotten fatter and ultra-processing is going on. But in terms of a rigorous study, it's not shown. I want to throw in one more horrifying thing from a classical liberal standpoint. He wants to go legally after medical journals who publish research that he doesn't like. And he wants to go after newspapers who print things on health that he disagrees with. This is a terrible attack on the First Amendment as well as the scientific process. So it's really troubling. And, I don't want to say, oh, he's a conspiracy theorist, because that's not the point. He's just wrong, and he doesn't have the kind of analytic mind. He has forcefulness, confidence in his wrongness. Conspiracy, whatever, you know, conspiracy just means people are doing things in private. It's an empirical question of whether there are, of course, people who do things in private. We all probably talk to our spouses and things like that in private. I don't think that word doesn't take us anywhere. The question is, what would he do to the American public and our rights? I mean, he claimed that COVID was an engineered disease in order to attack blacks and whites, and that Chinese and Ashkenazi Jews were immune. This is a kind of very crackpot theory.
Yeah, right. Oh, Bill, what if he used his bully pulpit against processing food, but didn't actually use the power of the government to stop it?
That's not that bad, but the problem is he's presiding over something that has a lot of power over the food industry, and he will be fostering unscientific attitudes in the public. It's hard to foster scientific attitudes in the public.
It's an interesting scenario because, the track record of the public health authorities over the past 4 years has been COVID.
That's brought us this.
Yeah, they've opened the door to where he is. I mean, when the bar is Anthony Fauci, I mean, there was basically no science operating whatsoever at any level of the federal government that made any sense.
That was politics and not science. And Scott Atlas's book, A Plague on Our House, is a great account of this. But that doesn't mean we should have a public health figure who believes we should ban canola oil and sunflower oil. Well, the man believes they are just poison, and he is completely wrong. They have been widely and deeply studied.
Well, one of the points he was going on about the other day was the high fructose corn syrup that's in all sorts of products. And you know, here's an interesting internal contradiction in the Trump administration. We wouldn't have high fructose corn syrup and Coca-Cola and then all our candy and snack foods if we didn't have all these sugar tariffs and corn subsidies in place.
That's right. That's right.
It would default to the world market of what we find in any other country on earth where natural sugar is the standard thing. So he's in some sense, he's identified, okay, maybe there's a problem with the fact that we have.
But he certainly doesn't have the right solution on this.
Exactly. And his boss, Donald Trump, seems to be going in the other direction on the exact thing.
His boss does love hamburgers, so yeah. We'll.
But that was a fun photo of McDonald's being served RFK Jr.
Yeah, yeah. I would say, you know, don't have a lot of sugar, whether it's whatever form it's in, white granular sugar, fructose, corn syrup, all of these things, in very moderate, they're fine. They help sweeten things, but you eat a lot of them, you will get fat and you will have medical problems.
But Phil, you just made a comment a moment ago that kind of slipped by, but I just wanted to like focus on it. The reason why there's such a pervasive use of high fructose corn syrup is
government policy.
Yeah, it's not because there's a big demand of consumers, but rather because, like, just say it clearly.
Yeah,
they have a tariff.
They have a tariff on one side and a subsidy on the other side.
They have a subsidy for corn production.
So the government, through its powers of tariff and subsidy, has actually been promoting high fructose corn syrup.
The very thing that RFK is complaining about is 100% a result of two bad government policies, and no other major economy in the world has this problem. They don't have the sugar tariffs and they don't have the corn subsidies.
Right. It's a simple fact, but most people are unaware of it. This is why there's all this corn syrup and everything.
That's why you go to Costco, you get your Coca-Cola from Mexico. It has real sugar.
Regular sugar.
Yeah.
But you're importing it back into the United States and paying a tariff on it.
Okay. But, you know, sugar is kind of sugar in a sense. It's very quickly changed in your body to be very similar. So you don't want a lot of either regular Mexico Coca-Cola type sugar or American corn fructose, a lot of it. Now, the kind of thing that's going on here is it's just he would be we shouldn't have him elevated on the public scene. It's just problematic. The establishment couldn't deserve this more, but the American people don't deserve to suffer what it's going to be.
So, okay, health issues are in focus with him, with RFK Jr., but also now suddenly because of UnitedHealthcare and the murder of their CEO. I mean, it's bizarre. We
have to turn it away from vaccination and fluoridation to assassination. And they all have to do with health issues. And apparently this guy who's been arrested has written stuff, screeds against the kind of medical system we have in the U.S., advocating for socialistic medicine and so forth. He's an anti-capitalist, some kind of ideologue. I guess he learned that in the Ivy League. What's going on here is people are lionizing him as if he were some kind of a hero. And so for Phil Magnus, the question is American health care and American health insurance so bad that really it's kind of like time to kill some of the guys?
Well, here's the interesting thing. I mean, American health care is far from an ideal system, but it's mainly that way because it's not a true market. It's not a price system. It's one of the most heavily regulated, government interfered with industries in the entire economy. It's something that, better part of a century of government interference in the healthcare sector has created this system of bureaucracy, no functional prices. You can't walk into a hospital and ask for a price on a procedure and get a clear answer from it. They have to consult the bureaucratic books that tell how much to be reimbursed on. It's just an absurdity. So there is a genuine grievance with the state of the healthcare industry, but it's not profiteering. It's not capitalism that's the cause here.
And why is it that classical liberals have so much trouble? I know. It's practically, the most hard thing to explain is how the Federal Reserve System works, okay? But the next most hard, difficult thing to explain to the general public is how the health system works. And we're getting nowhere, realistically, in rolling this back. The Republicans have kind of given up on repealing Obamacare. I'm not saying that Trump won't try and make some modifications, maybe even some big ones, but the Republicans never had an alternative that they fought for, and they don't now.
Well, it's an area where it's very easy to dispense rents. It's very easy to give out favors. A lot of it's extremely opaque in its pricing and funding mechanisms. There's heavy involvement of government grants and government subsidies. You have these ostensibly nonprofit hospitals that have privileged status under the tax system and the government, and yet they're turning millions of dollars in profits that an actual person would look at on the street, and they're saying, "Hey, this kind of does look like it's unfair." Does kind of look like a villainous caricature of capitalism. And then you overlay that, you've got an academic establishment that is ideologically wedded to getting a single-payer, socialized healthcare system.
So any step from that, even though it keeps perverting and twisting and causing counterproductive things, but if they see it as marching toward socialized medicine, then they'll support it, even though they could kind of step back, look at it, and even acknowledge this isn't going to work very well either, but we hope the frustration with it will drive us to accept full-born socialized medicine.
Yeah, and that's where you get the cheerleading. I mean, even before this guy was discovered, the suspect was discovered at a McDonald's in Pennsylvania, had people on the left, the academic left and the journalist left, were turning him into a folk hero. They're tweeting out celebration of the fact that he's been able to evade the police. They're portraying him as righteous and just.
He's Robin Hood.
He's Robin Hood with a murderer. I mean, it's really, frankly, obscene that they went that direction.
There's another thing I think we have to address here, and that is that any healthcare system has got to be able to review and deny requested services.
Sure.
And as a co-author with Phil pointed out, he gave a good example. He said, well, what if somebody says, I'm depressed, and the doctor prescribed, okay, we should build this man a 5-bedroom house, and that will fix his depression. Somebody has to say, no, we're not doing that. And if you had an all socialized system, somebody would say that. If you had our current system, somebody would be saying things like that. And if you had a pure free market, John Goodman type of system, somebody would be saying it. They have to say it because it can't just have an open-handed blank check situation. Now, and so that's going to mean that some people are frustrated. What they think should have been given as a service or a medication or some kind of medical equipment or something like that hasn't been given to them. And so they're going to not be happy. The world is somewhat like that.
Well, it's a socialized medical system that is a free-for-all for everyone. It rewards hypochondria. It rewards the people
not only that, but if you're denied under an all-socialist system, you have nowhere to turn.
Right.
Oh, exactly.
Whereas exists in the current system or in a free market, if you're denied, you can go to another provider. I mean,
it might be more expensive, but you can get around
the denial if a state somehow doesn't grant you what you want.
Yeah, the absence of pricing means that it's rationed through other means.
Exactly.
What you see in Britain and Canada and some other countries that have a much more socialized healthcare system, they ration by you wait in line. Or they ration by you have to get on a list.
It's a queue.
Yeah.
Yeah, last night I had dinner with a longtime friend of mine who's a physician in Ontario, Canada, part of the OHIP, you know, health system, which provides services to everyone. But basically, he says what it really means is that you're entitled to a place in line for the service. You're not entitled to service, you're entitled to a place in line, and it takes forever. And moreover, private doctors who participate in Ontario, Canada, apparently the allowed payments or reimbursements or services have been cut every year for 10 years. And so they're impoverishing or on the risk of impoverishing their medical providers in the name of providing universal care, which is actually not universal care, but a universal rationing. Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. And then here's this guy, Luigi Mangione, and he's saying, oh, he's striking a blow against this horrible free market, for-profit, capitalist healthcare system, which is anything but
it's a caricature.
Yeah. I mean, it may be for-profit, but the governmental regulation of the healthcare system has created such perverse incentives that profit seekers end up contorting the medical provision, even in the U.S. So he was so wrong. And as you said, the media championing him makes me sick. Another thing we ought to talk about today is another set of Trump appointees in economic policy. And I think Phil Magnus has been following this carefully. I asked in the case of foreign affairs and military appointees, was it a coherent team? I can ask the same question here of you, Phil. Are Trump's economic appointees cohering into a kind of a meaningfully consistent group?
So it's a mixed bag, as we kind of expected all along. I mean, Trump is personally wedded to protectionism. And I'd say my biggest concern when he started to roll out his cabinet, and I think the concern of a lot of people in the free market space, was that he was going to name a tariff person to one of the major agencies. So like Secretary of the Treasury, put him at the head of the Economics Council. If you put a protectionist in one of those places, that would give a line of encouragement directly to the president to exercise discretionary power to impose punitive tariffs at will. And the big concern here was Robert Lighthizer, who was the trade representative in the last Trump administration, of him coming back and getting a promotion to something like Treasury or the Commerce Department. Well, so far that has not happened. Scott Bessent, who was chosen at Treasury, is perceived as a much more moderate figure on that particular line than someone like Lighthizer.
Yeah. And so, the markets shot up when Bessent's nomination was announced.
Exactly.
So one thing we have to distinguish is the prospective nominees who have said tariffs are a negotiating leverage thing.
Right. And Bessent's
from people who say,
that.
Right. And so a couple of other people, but there's also people that want tariffs as a fence around the United States,
right,
and a super protectionist permanent policy.
And that was the Lighthizer approach. He's someone who thinks that America had it right at various points in the 19th century when we had high tariffs in place. He's basically the ideology behind the Smoot-Hawley Act in 1930. And having someone like that thus far being basically shut out from the appointment structure, I think is a good sign. So I've got my fingers crossed that hopefully it'll continue down that path. There are some concerns. So Peter Navarro was just named as like a special emissary or czar on tariffs and protection. He was another of these characters from the first Trump administration that was, you know, shut down the borders both physically and commercially. And the fact that he's in the mix and will be advising the president probably does not portend all that well, because I think he feeds into some of Trump's worst instincts on tariffs.
And the funny thing is that Navarro knows better.
He does.
He wrote a brilliant, he wrote an excellent book when he was young, saying protectionism is a form of rent seeking, of special privilege seeking, and it's distorting, and it costs fall on the consumer. And if we put up tariff barriers, they're going to fall on the American public. And then he just flipped on this.
Yeah.
There's also a fellow named Greer, I believe,
who's right
in there, and has got some troubling views.
Right. Right. Yeah. As the U.S. Trade Representative, I'm not expecting great things out of that. I think it does veer in a protectionist direction, which is what Trump has been all along. I worry some of the American Compass, Orrin Cass type think tanks that are advising people. I'm actually much more concerned that they seem to have the ear of J.D. Vance as vice president. Because whereas Trump is a tariff man in his rhetoric and his convictions, he does not have a very deep understanding of the mechanisms of what tariffs do. And we see this on display all the time. He thinks that tariffs can both be a new tax system and a protective system. These two goals are in conflict with each other. You can't have one without and simultaneously pursue the other, because if you raise tariffs for revenue, that means goods cross borders. You can't get protection. If you raise tariffs for protection, goods stay out of the country because the tax is too high and you can't get revenue from them. Trump doesn't seem to understand that, which tells me he doesn't have a very deep comprehension of the issue, whereas someone like Vance, Orrin Cass, Lighthizer, and Navarro, at least for political reasons, seem to subscribe to this ideology where tariffs are like this, it's almost like a right-wing version of central planning, where you can order the economy in such a way that you get the industries that you strategically want, you keep out things that you dislike, and steer the economy supposedly to prosperity, which I think is utter nonsense. I mean, it fails for the same reason that Soviet five-year plans fail. You've obviated the price mechanism through this distortionary practice of tariffs. And as soon as that's in place, you know, the vultures descend, the rent seekers descend, the tariff becomes entrenched and impossible to change. And you're basically saddled with a bad policy.
And you saw under the first Trump administration, hundreds of companies, thousands of companies coming in and saying, well, we need an exemption. And then there are political transactions, whether in public or somewhere behind people's back.
Yeah. And it's one of these issues also. I think that there are elements on the political left that are very conducive to protectionism.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders and Trump are not all that far apart when it comes to their tariff policies. The New York Times was providing a cheerleading forum for Lighthizer to be appointed to something. They kept bringing in all these op-eds that were saying Lighthizer is the way to go in the Trump Treasury Department and stuff. This is a paper that's to the left of the left in terms of its economic views, and it favors the same tariffs that some of these protectionist cranks favor. And I think it brings us back to like a horseshoe of economic planners versus economic free markets. And you got planners on the left, planners on the right, converging around tariffs. But then you have free market voices that are, it's going to be a role that I think most of us will have to play probably for the next 4 years in continuing to make that case for free trade on principle and evidence.
So I think, you know, there's some grounds for hope in that the people that want to just use it for leverage, the Stephen Moores of the world and so forth, they are in the mix still. And yet
they
the other problem,
some of the discussions over these ideologues, basically.
Yes, but there's also the attempt to woo the trade unions, the labor unions, many labor unions. Certainly when I was growing up, you know, in the late 50s, early 1960s, the labor unions in the United States were extremely protectionist made the Democratic Party protectionist. There were always some internationalist Democrats, and over time, pro-free trade people did rise up in the Democratic Party. But right now, the Democrats and the Republicans are both trying to compete for the white working class, and what can they throw them? Well, one thing they can throw them.
Tariffs.
You know, which at first glance seem to be favorable. Obviously, we have a deeper understanding of how they actually will end up hurting those workers.
Yeah. But we can't talk about Trump's economic policy and prospects without mentioning Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. Of course, Elon, apparently, he is the solution to every problem. He's kind of a panacea, it seems. Like you toss Elon wherever you have a problem. But regarding the government efficiency, so-called department, I'm having trouble understanding, Phil, how a massive reduction in federal expenditures could be achieved while keeping off the table the largest elements of the federal budget, namely transfer payments and interest on the debt.
Yeah.
I mean, these things are off the table. And what percentage of the whole are transfer payments and interest, do you think?
I mean, transfer payments and interest are probably the two biggest components. I mean, you're talking trillions of dollars every year, whereas, you know, they're debating over maybe we can change $10 billion here. We can save $15 billion there. It's
yeah,
a,
but they're
a drop
talking
in the
about $2 trillion.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you delete agencies, if you delete programs, if you radically change the defense posture of the United States, you could still do, you could do that. And, you know, you'd certainly have to get big gains out of reorienting the Defense Department.
Right, right.
But let's say you have no more fighter aircraft and you just use drones.
You could save
like
money.
That, retire aircraft carriers. I mean, there are things that you could do that start to add up.
Yeah.
A billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon it adds up to real money.
And you do have to start somewhere. So I applaud the effort to rein in, you know, the $1,000 toilet seats that the Pentagon has been purchasing. I applaud the effort to find very obvious instances of waste and bring it under control. I mean, I find it completely obnoxious that even small amounts of my tax dollars are funding crazy left-wing advocacy under the name of doing science and academia and social sciences, even though it's just a drop in the bucket. So yes, there's rooms to start on some smaller programs. I just caution anyone from being overly optimistic that this thing is going to deliver us from our deficit problem.
Well, we saw the Grace Commission.
We
saw the reinventing government. We saw a variety of things going back a number of administrations, many, practically all the 20th century administrations tried to do something. But they, you know, I think it's great to have this goal.
As I said to
somebody, I know people who think the government was too big under Thomas Jefferson. Okay. So there are a lot of views out there.
Yeah.
But the point is, these guys have a lot of panache. They have a lot of drive. They're quite smart. And they really, you know.
Well, in the last four presidencies.
Vivek really has an ideological view.
Yeah, he does.
He has this kind of national libertarianism that he promotes. He understands it. It's not my view exactly, or any of ours, but it would lead to a lot smaller government.
Yeah, I believe both of them are genuine about cutting budgets, and the last four administrations have not even paid any attention to the question. They haven't even cared. It's George W. Bush, Barack Obama, the first Trump administration, and the Biden administration. It was just spend whatever, whenever on anything you need. And what did it eventually lead us to? It's fiscal profligacy and, more broadly beyond that, the inflationary problem that we had.
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming toward the end of our hour here. Can you just tell me something completely different, Bill? I'm trying to understand the federal court that upheld the ban on TikTok. Well, why did they uphold the ban on TikTok? That's surprising.
Okay, so the debate is over the following. It's Chinese owned, and people give some information to it, and it can glean some information about people from what they submit and how they interact with it. Now, the problem is, you know, if you effectively shut down, so you can say, oh, they're just having to sell it. No, you can't really sell it because you need the algorithm. China will not let them sell the algorithm. Therefore, you can't sell it. Even if China said, oh, sure, sell the algorithm, it'd be very complicated. There would be antitrust problems. There would be capitalization problems for the purchaser. It's just essentially they're really banning it. Now, the ACLU, Pan America, various civil liberties groups point out the following. What do you think you're doing? You are denying First Amendment rights to 170 million regular users of TikTok, and you don't have a compelling state interest. If you're going to infringe on a fundamental right, which free speech certainly is, you better have a serious, imminent, that means right now looming, threat to national security or some other public safety thing, and they don't have it. They don't have it. This is just convenient. It's also something that Facebook has put its major international lobbyist, Nick, and he unfortunately comes from a very attenuated classical liberal party in Britain, but we all have our burden severe, we classical liberals. Anyway, he's been their lobbyist, and, you know, Facebook would love to shut down TikTok because they hope they would move into the space, the market space.
So it's a bootlegger's Baptist argument.
Oh, yeah.
That's how these things plays out.
It's a very bad thing. I think we should also not neglect this fellow, Brendan Carr, who's coming in at the Federal Trade Commission.
Well, he's going to fix
federal communication.
The FCC, yeah.
So well, he's going to fix the censorship, right?
Yeah, he's for this TikTok ban, but he also wants to. So there's a thing called Section 230, which says that if you're a platform operator in the media, the people who post on your platform, you don't have to be responsible for that. You're just holding the platform and they're doing their thing. And if somebody has a problem, a legal problem with them, you go after the poster. You go after the person who puts
it's insulation from liability.
Right. Now, that doesn't mean that the people that are running the platform can't edit. They can't say, I want to block this person. He's a national socialist. He's a violent communist. He's a racist that I don't want on my platform. They can still do that, but they're held. You couldn't operate these platforms if they had to monitor in detail
every single post on there. Yeah.
So if you get rid of this Section 230, that essentially ends the media. So Carr has at various times said he's in favor of getting rid of it. And he's also sometimes said, well, Section 30 should only be allowed if the platform is operating in good faith. Oh. This is a typical bureaucratic or political weasel word. Operationally, what does this mean? This means discretionary power on the part of government and political regulators to decide what is operating in good faith. So this is not a person we really want in charge of it. Speech and broadcast and cable and internet agency. Carr has not gone as far as Trump in the following sense. Trump at various times, and it's not clear how, just like whether he's going to go after the Biden family, has kind of modified his position back to what he had toward Hillary Clinton during his own administration, where he didn't prosecute her. I think it looks now like he's not going to actually go after the Biden family, which I think is probably healthy for our political culture that he not do that. But even though they did some bad things, I mean, they clearly had an influence peddling racket. But Trump has said that he wants to yank broadcast licenses. And he relies on the fact that hidden in the Federal Communications Act is that the licensees are supposed to operate in the public interest. And so the regulators can go after them.
And broadly define that, yeah.
Yes. So again, it's one of these slippery words that gives a loophole you can drive a truck through or whatever you want to say. Now, really, of course, classical liberals, going back to Ronald Coase and other people, have long said, and people who have looked into the history of this have long said, that there's no reason homesteading principles cannot apply to the at least the broadcast airways. Now, cable is obviously done in a different way. But point is, we don't really have the supposed, and it was false even then, scarcity argument.
Yeah.
For regulating the broadcasting sphere.
Operating under court decisions from the 1930s with commensurate understanding of technology.
Right. They were wrong then, and the technology has made for a much huger diversity of transmitters. So I'm not pleased with him, and this is an area that we have to watch. On his good side, because I think have to be fair to these people, he has correctly pointed out that the major social media companies connived. I'm not saying they didn't have a property right to do it, but they connived and they supported this new shield thing in order to exclude things that they didn't like during the COVID lockdown and in relation to other public policy issues. So he's right to be alert to that, but, you know, look at Musk's purchase of Twitter/X. This addressed it. There's plenty of freedom now in that space. So anyway, I think we need to watch Mr. Carr and see. All these people, by the way, were going into their previous views. The president and the president's staff is really going to be decisive. In other words,
that's true.
J.D. Vance has some view. Marco Rubio has some view. You know what? If Trump and the immediate White House staff doesn't want to do that, they're not going to do it, or they're going to be gone. So, you know, people always say, oh, the king didn't do it. It was the king's counselors operating independent of him.
Well, he'll blame the counselors does is unpopular.
That's right. No, it's the king that does it. And so it's true in a presidential system, too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both for unpacking some of these tangled webs for us. We are, you might say, here at Independent Institute, kind of always on patrol to watch for the fate of liberty as these policy issues get worked out one way or another. And we'll keep you all informed as best we can. Of course, I invite our friends and viewers also to visit frequently our webpage, independent.org, where we always have a bunch of new, interesting, and well-researched pieces that are worth reading. I just was checking the webpage today. You should go there and see what we've recently written about some of these and other topics. So again, Phil Magnus, thank you.
Thanks.
And Bill Evers, for you too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Come back next time to Independent Outlook. Take care, everybody.